apparently looked like it was coming up. It wasn't coming up. It stand still. The earth was going down. Therefore, many people had an absolute conviction that subsidence was caused by the graving box. I'm looking to see. Well, they're not. This whole pretty good sized envelope was truly harbor, and it is not. I will fold this up then. Being not harbor. I've given other general references, not necessarily, but they, here is the Long Beach, Santa Ana area, groundwater geology. This is a shallow geology. If there ever was a student who covered everything of all this, they would be aware of the shallow geology. Another process. I thought I had done a better winnowing job. Continuously, we are run 7-inch casing into which we insert tubing. Into the tubing, we put the sucker rods, the rods, must run up and down. We never run sucker rods on top, inside of 7-inch casing. We must always confine them. You can think of that in quite a bit of what we do, something like a speedometer cable. The speedometer cable functions only because we have it within a tight housing. So the housing for the rod is 2.5-inch tubing. The 2.5-inch tubing rests within 7-inch. The annulus is that space, donut shape, between the tubing and the casing. And continuously, when in operations, we circulate down the tubing and up the annulus. And we circulate down the annulus and up the tubing. We live with the annulus in many cases. When we dig a 9 5/8 hole and put 7-inch casing, the annulus is that space between the 9 5/8 hole and the 7-inch casing. And right above the oil zone, we find a shale, and we fill that annulus full of cement for 200, 300, 400 feet, in which we attempt to prevent either the migration of oil upward into the annulus and out into strata, or the water, oil always lies below water, or from the water traversing down the annulus and entering the oil sand. Sometimes our cement job at the shoe of the 7-inch resting in the 9 5/8 hole does not fill the 7-inch, the 9 5/8 annulus properly, leaving channels or conduits someplace through it, and when we try to put the well on, we get an unrestrained flow of water from above. We then have to go back in and re-squeeze, in which we now perforate a hole in the 7-inch, or 2 or 3 or 4 holes, squeeze cement with high pressure, trying to find the channel or conduit which was inadvertently left. And in such case, when we're successful, we put the well back on, and no water comes from the above water-bearing strata, known as aquifers, down the annulus and into the oil zone and up the pump. So God help us if what we do, you can say petroleum engineering is a form of kind of, I don't know, high grade, but a form of plumbing in which we are always putting pipes inside of pipes and outside of pipes and going to drain an oil sand down there. And without the annulus, we would be helpless. In one case, we have to move things. And we also have trouble with it. A well will cease to flow under its natural conditions of gas coming out and commingling with the oil, making a bit of a froth, and the froth being lighter, and the pressure here, we flow 5, 10,000, 20,000 barrels a day if the pressure is there. We at times put a packer on the tubing, place down, and pack off the annulus. Annulus between the 2.5-inch tubing and the 7-inch casing at 7,000 feet. When you kill that annulus, notice now we've killed the annulus as far as surges of oil and gas through the perforated liner can only go up through the tubing. It can't bounce in the annulus. When we do that, we prolong the flowing life because the oil and gas are directed together and don't dissipate by producing oscillations of pressure in the annulus. Then that packer sticks so badly that we can't get it out except by drilling. And drilling it out with a mill may ruin the whole zone. And again, there's a case where we attempted to control the nature, to block off or get rid of the annulus as an element in a flowing oil. I might say, in the case of a pumping well, we'd often pull a vacuum on the annulus to get more gas. And when you do, you increase the rate of flow of oil. So you're pumping. If you want to increase the flow of oil doing nothing else, all you have to do, if you have 100 pounds on the annulus, put a vacuum line to the absorption plant and produce a slight vacuum on the annulus, and you get more oil and more gas. So heavens to Betsy, we live with the annulus and the annuli.
You also said that the lithified?
Yes. Lithification is lithology, is the study of rock.
Yeah.
And lithification is be the process in which a liquid mud, you could say that on the surface, if you have a very muddy spot and the sun comes out and the wind blows and finally comes hard like a brick, you can say it has lithified, the mud has lithified. Lithification is the process. So the mud, which is about, I believe, 70 or 80% solid, the mud that we use, maybe 50%. So there is about the proposal or the probability or the, not only that, the probability that that mud, that the solid, given time, will settle out. So you have a solid 99%, 98% solids and water above, and so you have a lithification of a mud, and the mud is a pea soup consistency.
Mud? Yes.
Mud originally was pure clay,
yes,
and water.
I know.
Yes, Mojave and Wilmington Slough, there Wilmington Slough was aided by the fact of a thing we call, in particular in mining, is slime. fine is where the fines are so fine that it has a greasy, soapy slickness. So Wilmington Slough had that property. And Wilmington Slough was a big mud. Now, muds are a great deal of chemicals and artificial materials, and not so much, just pure. When I first went roughnecking in 1933 for Union Oil in Kettleman Hills, we used pure mud with no additives. When it got worn, it was discarded and new mud was brought in. I have here a brown file folder in which I see that Jan Law's letterhead, writing to the Board of Harbor Commissioners and writing to Charles Vickers, court manager, and written to by Hamilton, United States, the United Navy Electronics Laboratory. He was asking for information on subsidence. Converse, who headed the Caltech soil mechanics, did the extensive soil testing at 4,000 or 5,000 feet, unique to soil testing. So there is correspondence that was serious. Here are the worksheets by which the collar count device was converted into the diagrams that you've probably seen in the Jan Law report on interrelationships, where they're shown extensions to the right representing shortening consolidation. Here were the basic data collected in the truck sitting beside the oil well as the wire line would pass down and brought slowly up the hole. That is how the data was digested to make available. Here is a letter to Richter. Richter of the Richter scale of intensity of seismological, of seismic earthquakes, was quite interested in Wilmington subsidence because in the course of subsidence he built up shear which cut 300 oil wells, which in turn was written up in the annals of seismic as a major earthquake, because there major earthquakes are measured in dollars, although it was so gentle that it was barely felt. It was barely felt by people. The earthquake investigations in the United States is a layman's treatment of how earthquakes are measured, and you will find in there why the Wilmington shears were unique in that. All of our California earthquakes originated about 10 miles deep and received at the Caltech Seismological Laboratory are three kinds of waves. One is a purely pulsation in a straight line. The last one's called the Raleigh, like Sir Walter Raleigh, R-E-I-G-H-L-E-Y, Sir Walter Raleigh. It's a wave at the surface called the Raleigh wave, and it has no component of expansion either this way or this way in along the line of traverse. It's a surface wave. That's the only thing that reached Caltech. Therefore, it was a shear at 1,400 feet, not an earthquake at 10 miles. And that was rather unique. I don't know how unique to the annals of seismology, but Richter was quite interested in it. Here is a letter to Mayor Raymond C. Keeler. It was interesting. Keeler was not only a member of the city council for many years, he was also a member of the board of harbor commissioners, and he was mayor and was a politician for many years. And his background, of all things, was running a wire line in the hole. He worked for Pat Elliott. Elliott had a water witching service, and a water witch used an odometer to tell you where the instrument was and the wire line, and it was very little for Pat Elliott, who was also on the board of harbor commissioners, and Ray Keeler, to understand the validity of color count, which was dependent upon the odometer. The odometer being, it said, when you started in, it said 0 feet. As you lowered it, there was 1,000 feet of cable in the hole, then there was 2,000 feet, and finally 7,000 feet. Then you brought it slowly out, and the collars were recorded as being, we'll say, 7,000 feet, then at 30 feet up, 6,970 feet, and then 30 feet up, 6,940 feet. I'm going the wrong way. 6,940 feet, so on. And we were capturing those. Well, maybe color count would never have been left to people believing enough to pay the bill and listen to it and hire me as a full-time consultant for the Harbor Department, except that, of all things, Mayor Raymond Keeler, at that time, Board of Harbor Commissioner, and Elliott Board of Harbor Commissioner, knew all about wireline and knew what was going on and could understand and advocate the thing, and it might have died in the, and my work, my contribution, might have died a mourning in the absence of two men who happened to have been dedicated for years to wire line odometers and the understanding of them. Amazing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure this was a duplicate, but the Goose Creek was the original subsidence caused by oil. And it had, to us, a very interesting story. In the state of Texas, if land was above sea level, it could be claimed by individuals transferred by deed and fee simple. But if the land was submerged below the level of the ocean, it could not be owned by an individual or party. It could only be owned by the state of California, by the state of Texas. And here was a little field which was located on Goose Creek, being part of Galveston Sound, being on in Galveston Sound and saltwater affair, it had a swift acting subsidence. It did go big portions of its portions, significant portions, went below sea level. Therefore, the state of Texas said, well, fine, we now own it, and you don't owe it, but don't own it. We, the state of Texas, own it, and they instituted legal procedures to take the former privately owned oil production away from them, awarded to the state. Well, they had a big, at that time, lawsuit in which Wallace E. Pratt, was a big, one of the biggest men in geology. He had the reputation of, say, the Mayo brothers or in medicine. He was a big man. He took the stand in order to prove that the subsidence was man-made and not an act of God. And if it was man-made and not an act of God, therefore the title didn't transfer, because submergence was only considered to be valid as a result of the operation of nature's or process or an act of God. So they successfully proved to the court in the state of Texas that oil extraction caused subsidence. And those people who later were contemplating lawsuits and were justifying their position that oil caused subsidence in Wilmington found a great deal of comfort in the, I'm looking at the Journal of Geology of 1926, Local Subsidence in the Goose Creek Oil Field, and I'm looking at a technical paper published, it sure looks like, in the Journal of Geology, in which those of us who believed, the bottom of my heart, that oil caused subsidence, and this was pre-collar count or pre-acceptance of collar count, got comfort from the fact that in the pretty good court, Superior Court or something, that oil caused subsidence in Texas by virtue of the judge. What do we call them? Fugitive. Imperative meeting of operators in the Fault Block 2 and 3, Wilmington. Several conversations have been held with Mr. Roberts, acting subsidence control administrator of the Wilmington oil field, to determine whether or not the unit operators in Fault Block 2 or 3 would consider the special problems of the small operators in this area, now ready to be unitized. These meetings were attended by Crail, Victory Oil Company, Kingman of Mobile, Anchor, Tom McChilton of Axis Petroleum, and so on. And they are laying down the imperative meeting to meet subsidence, to unitize, to allow injection to meet subsidence. Land subsidence problems in the San Joaquin Valley. Two copies of the Subsidence Act. When you heard them talk about 138 over and over again, this is 138. The essence of it was, this is 138 or not. The essence of it is that in the threat of inundation, why mandatory unitization was legal. Unitization had been thrust upon the operators of Texas by virtue of the strong state legislature and this no question bias in favor of oil operators and recalcitrant operators who wouldn't join were in Texas by law were forced. In California, if you can remember, we have Proposition 4, Proposition 5. We had a big octopus and wrote against the octopus being the Standard Oil of California. And successfully, the voters of California warded off mandatory unitization by virtue of these initiatives. Those hard-working, independent operators that financed that were such people as Keck of Superior Oil, Killen Keck, and Starr, and other people who successfully, but they were getting older, but they still had momentum. And the Subsidence Act provided that there could be mandatory unitization under the threat of inundation. And it permitted injection, repressuring, and Wilmington.
My trolley project is collecting people saying things like, yes, that was Keck, Killen Keck. When Rinko wrote his book about the oil fields.
Who?
Bill Rinko, who writes for the oil and gas.
Okay.
Wrote a book about the oil fields, and he said that it was dangerous on those oil wells and everything. But he didn't, and he talked about people who had direct drillers who had the reputation of going fast and not worrying about their workers. But he called them Killen Smith. He didn't want to lie to anyone. So I'm collecting information about whether or not it was really just a kid.
Oh, when I went roughnecking in 1933, for Union Oil in Cattleman Hills, there was a Keck lease near us, and his reputation of Killen Keck and extraordinary. He had the biggest, finest trucks going over the old Ridge Route and Grapevine. He had the biggest, the first ones to get 350-pound boilers. We were have 250-pound boilers. He got 350. Always he was driving. I've been on his floor, not working for him, but as an observer, and watched their tool pushers. One of them was Slim Law, and we tried to get common ancestry, and we couldn't. But Killen Keck was notorious, and like a folk story, part of the thing, the extraordinary limits to which he would go. And they would say that if a man was injured out cold, that they might send somebody and try to carry him or so on, but they wouldn't stop drilling. They'd keep right on drilling just as fast as they could, and they'd drag the poor devil off and try to get him to an ambulance or a car, but they didn't shut down. And that drive, which he was able to inculcate into his tool pushers, and there wasn't a tool pusher that wasn't rough as could be, really rough. Sam Roberts went off a carbon copy to Lee Osborne, who was management committee of Box 3 and 4, Dam Subsidence Affair. I submitted one of the first things to you and A House was my interstitial heterogeneity. Well, here's a man who stole my paper permeability distribution and water flood calculation, and quite blatantly used the findings without giving credit, but there it is. It's called Mr. Use Permanent Distribution Water Flood Calculation Styles. And this was published. This is a paper, A Statistical Approach to Coal Analysis Interpretation by Jan Law and Serena Union Oil. This was published, I believe, in 1946 in the bound volume of the American Petroleum Institute. The American Petroleum Institute is more or less the trade organization of the industry. It is not like the Institute of Mining and Metallurgical Engineers, which is a professional membership. Native and contaminated groundwaters in the Long Beach, Santa Ana area. That's different from the other, but it's